All righty. Good morning. Let's go ahead and call this meeting to order, and let's begin with a roll call, please.
Estela Hernandez.
Here.
Carlicia Bradley Williams.
Here.
Kurt Bombach.
Here.
Phil Flanagan.
Here.
Brian Bobek.
Here.
Jennifer Mendes.
Here.
Here. All right. And we have a quorum. Do we comply with the Open Meetings Act? Excellent. Thank you, board members and guests who are with us. Thank you so much for being with us today. Would you please join me for a Pledge of Allegiance, a salute to the Oklahoma flag, followed by a moment of silence, please. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. I salute the flag of the state of Oklahoma. Its symbols of peace unite all people. Thank you. Please be seated. All right. Well, it's so nice to see everybody who's with us. I have one special recognition in the audience I want to give. Senator Dossett is with us, so thank you for joining us. All of those who traveled to be with us today and join us, it means a lot. And honorable board members, it is always great to see everyone. And we have great weather for January, so this is pretty good. I know one of you was in better weather just recently. But we are glad everyone is back. So we've got a couple things to visit with you about since last we met. First, I have to just brag on some amazing team members that are here. In fact, we have one that all of the employees here at the State Department wanted to celebrate this month, and it's Lakeisha Simon. She is a senior education data analyst. There you are. So, Carlicia, Lakeisha, that's a tongue twister because we just did it the opposite direction. All right. So, Lakeisha, would you come to the podium? And I want to read a little bit about you. Lakeisha was nominated by three of her coworkers, and one of them said, over the past month, Lakeisha has gone above and beyond in support of internal staff and district personnel during key data collections, including the October 1st consolidated report and the first quarter statistical report. Her expert knowledge and consistently pleasant attitude is assisting district superintendents, district staff, as well as many others, as a result in every district being certified in the October 1 consolidated report, which is a record number of districts certifying their first quarter statistical report, more than 500, and most importantly, a rebuilt trust between the agency and districts, and that you had an enormous hand in, and I am really grateful, and we agree so much. Another coworker said, Lakeisha is always patient and thorough when giving information. She has been an absolutely vital part in building our network of data and communication with districts. I know that there are many, many things that you do that we don't even realize make the work of this agency run even smoother to serve school districts. And it is critical that districts have a way to communicate related to their data, because that allows for us to have clean data and good information going forward so that we can act on that data. So you have a big part in that, and I appreciate it. And I want to come up there and give you an Employee of the Month certificate, and let's get a picture. So thank you. Okay. All right. So now, Debbie Hamilton. We need to talk about Debbie. Debbie Hamilton is retiring. And I want to ask Debbie if you would also first introduce your guest with us.
This is my husband, Lyndall Hamilton.
Lyndall.
Before you get to be 37 years.
Wow, that's fabulous. Well, please go to the podium. And thank you, Wendell, for being with us. Debbie will be retiring from her position, and as you know, she is the Executive Director of Child Nutrition here at the department, and she will be retiring in the first week of February. And we also want to just kind of give you a little bit of a update and background about some of what Debbie has done. She's had a long history of service in the state of Oklahoma and in schools, and taught in Hydro, bet you didn't know this, Mountain View, Mangum. I want to say Magnum. Mangum. And Cordell before joining the Office of Child Nutrition at the State Department in 2007. And then in July of 2015, Debbie was named Executive Director of this department. Debbie's 39 years of service to Oklahoma children translates to millions and millions and millions of meals served and countless minds nourished and helping them with our Food for Thought program, really, when we think about it. It is about being ready to learn and goes right with that concept of we have to meet those Maslow hierarchy of needs before our kids can bloom with Bloom's taxonomy. So we got a Maslow before we can bloom. So we are so grateful for you and your contributions, and this is truly extraordinary service, and you have made quite the impact on hundreds of thousands of children.
Sure. My people know me. I don't ever give up that opportunity. The Lord blessed me about 13 years ago and brought me here. Never, ever saw myself in this position. I was a high school home economics teacher. But, you know, you talk about the lives you've touched over the years. Facebook is a fun thing because, you know, you have kids that post things. And if I comment, they go, oh, your class. It was my favorite class. And that just makes you feel so good. But I also was blessed with a great mentor here at the State Department, and that was Joni Hildenbrand, and some of you may know that name and remember that name. She taught me, and she said no question was too lame to be answered. And when she got ready to retire, she said, Debbie, you have to be the one to do this. And I said, oh, no, I can't do that. Yes, you can. And I think now I look back on that, and maybe that's what God needed me to do the last 4 years, 4.5 years, to make the way, the transition good for her. Our systems are up and going. Life is good in 310. So it's time to go. So thank you very much. Thank you for the opportunities. I've worked with some awesome people in this administration and former administrations, and I've been very blessed.
Well, so. It is our pleasure to thank get to be here with you as you start your next chapter.
Yeah. All right. And I will say that Superintendent Hoffmeister has been a joy to work with. She is joy, and she has been a joy to work with.
Yeah, that just kind of happened to work out.
But she really has. She's thank very you. Supportive of our department. And, you know, we're one of those odd folks up there on third floor. We're federal. You know, we fall under the Department of Agriculture and have kind of different sets of bosses in different places. So it's kind of a interesting exchange, but you have been wonderful, and we appreciate that.
Thank you.
Speak for
We're all on one big team. So, excellent. Thank you again. Thank you so much. So, also, in January, board members. Oh, yeah! So you've got a whole team out there.
Oh,
that's awesome. All right. Fabulous. January is also School Board Recognition Month, and in that spirit, we would like to make a special presentation to Dr. Sean Heim, the Executive Director of the Oklahoma State School Board Association, who is here today. So I'm going to read about this resolution, and Dr. Heim, in just a moment, I'll ask you to come to the podium, and we'll take a picture. Because we've never had one together. I know it. Okay, so whereas education is vital to Oklahoma's school children, our local communities, and our state's future, and whereas the furthering of that education is dependent not only upon teachers, but also upon the support of families, administrators, the local community, and the local board of education, and whereas school board members share and demonstrate a commitment to serve, investing many hours, and this board knows what that means too, of volunteer labor to help ensure Oklahoma students are given every opportunity to excel through education. And whereas school board members lead and govern with vision, passion, and purpose, and their actions and decisions affect the present and future lives of each of Oklahoma's school children. And whereas it is appropriate that the tireless dedication of our school board members be saluted during School Board Recognition Month in January 2020, therefore I, Joy Hoffmeister, do hereby express my appreciation to Oklahoma's school board members for their service to children, their communities, and our great state. So this represents a small token of our appreciation and gratitude for approximately 2,700 men and women of local school boards serving more than 703,000 Oklahoma students in public education. And it would not be possible without the dedication of those individuals. And we have special gratitude for the association that also equips them and keeps them current with training as well. So on behalf of them, I know it will be my honor if you would come.
We'll add these six to our number.
Okay.
Excellent. And yes, we can add this to our album of photos.
That's right. That's right.
And
congratulations.
For a number of years.
And here is this. Very good. Any words or
anything else? No, thank you. Okay.
I do have flashbacks of standing in this place. I do want to thank this board as well, because I've talked to many of you over the last few years since you've been on the board, and I understand the time you give to serve, and you get exactly the same paycheck as those 2,700 board members, and many of you miss work and time with your families for this service. So thank you for your service to our state and all of those 703,000 students.
Excellent. Thank you very much. We appreciate you. Okay, so board members, I have just two things to mention before we dive in. One is that our student advisory group is a council of students, and they're going to meet coming up this month. 104 high school students from all over Oklahoma have been named to the 2020 Student Advisory Council. If you're ever able to attend one of these, we meet twice a year, and it's pretty special. So we'll be doing that. We'll get dates and times and things to you. This is the fifth year for the group. Feedback from the council has actually resulted and been instrumental in state-level changes, including ICAP, replacing the end of course at the high school testing and making a way for ACT or SAT, something of value for students after they graduate. 24 of those who will be participating are returning, so they have not graduated yet, and they will continue. And this will be, our first meeting is going to be Wednesday at the state capitol, so it's going to be very, very special. So speaking of special, the U.S. Department of Education is visiting Oklahoma right now, and you might have seen on Twitter, I know that some of the board members where they are attending some of the, visiting some of the schools were invited. I know Mr. Bobeck was able to participate yesterday on some school tours. it was, I had opportunity to also meet with Secretary Frank Brogan. It's great to have someone of his expertise at the U.S. Department of Ed in this position, having been a former state chief himself. He knows what it's like to be in my shoes and also to also be a school superintendent. So he has a lot of experience as well as running as the our equivalent of the chancellor for the state of Pennsylvania. And also he was the state superintendent in Florida at one time. He visited Blanchard High School, Flower Mound School in Lawton, White Bead School in Paul's Valley, Dove Science Academy High School here in Oklahoma City, the Oklahoma Youth Academy Charter School in Tecumseh, and today Secretary Brogan is scheduled to go to Booker T. Washington and to Bishop Kelly High School, as well as Darnaby Elementary in Union Public School. All of those three are going to be part of a Tulsa visit. So we're very pleased to have this surprise visit, and they selected schools based on data and particular grants that they are working with those schools over time, and they wanted to come and check in on that progress. So we think it's a good thing, and we're so glad. Do you have any comments or remarks from your visit yesterday, Mr. Bobek?
He brilliant man. I really enjoyed him. He was doing a lot of work. He also served as lieutenant governor in Florida.
Yes.
And Florida has done some remarkable things with their public education, so he brings great value, to, as you've already said, Joy, to the position. And I was honored to be with him for several hours yesterday. So, great guy. And, it was wonderful that he was here.
All right. Very good. Thank you so much. So we're excited for him to see more of our state and our kids in great schools. All right. So now, board members, we are on item 4A, which is the first action item, discussion and possible action on the minutes of the December 19, 2019 regular state board meeting. Is there a motion to approve?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Motion to approve. Is there a second?
I had one question.
Sure.
In regards to the minutes. I believe on page 5, okay, the fourth paragraph that starts off with Brad Clark, General Counsel.
Mm-hmm.
After the words Charter School Act, it says allows, and I believe that should be does not allow.
Okay. Let me just find where that
is. Mr. Clark,
I
don't know if you might want to read that and see if.
Yeah, unfortunately, I don't have the minutes in front of me, but.
I'm going to try to also find exactly where you are. Can you tell me, is it page?
Yeah, it's page 5.
Page 5,
and
okay.
It's the appeal of charter school denial by Harlow Creek. And go down to paragraph 4.
Okay.
See, it starts with Brad Clark.
4, yes.
And I believe after the words advises. Charter School Act, I think it should be does not allow.
Oh, I see. So
that,
yeah.
That is correct.
Good catch.
Okay, excellent. I'm very, very glad that you caught that. All right, so do we want to amend the minutes? To include the word does not. So moved? Okay, is there a second? All right, we have a proper second. Okay, all right, call the roll, please.
Mr. Menden?
Aye. Mr. Bobek?
Aye.
Mr. Flanagan?
Yes.
Ms. Williams Bradley?
Changed it.
Okay, thanks.
Mr. Ballenbach?
Aye.
Ms. Hernandez?
Aye.
Aye. Okay, that motion carries as amended. Very important catch. Thank you for that. All right. Item 5, public comment.
We've got to go back now and vote on. We just changed the word, but we never did vote on accepting the minutes.
Actually, I think that what we did was we voted to approve as amended.
Okay. That's fine.
Okay. Very good. All right, very good. Thank you. Item 5, public comment. We have one person for public comment today, and that is Barbara Bowersock. Barbara, welcome, and come to the podium. The business, this is in regard to one of our rules, the length of schools, and thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having this opportunity. My name is Barbara Bowersox. I speak in support of the proposed rule on length of school term. I wear many hats. I'm an attorney, wife, mother, taxpayer, founder of an Oklahoma City school and most recently served on this committee, but I'm also been an advocate for Oklahoma schools for calendar, for Oklahomans for school calendar reform. Our group was loose-knit, but we accomplished a interim study in 2018, and we'd like to take some credit on influencing the recent change in the state testing window. I've served twice on the Oklahoma City Schools Calendar Committee, about 15 years apart, and both times in the midst of a statewide budget crisis. Those experiences revealed the need for parameters for setting calendars, as this proposal provides. The first time, it seemed that the priority was the children and the need to maximize instructional time before state testing. The second time, it seemed it was the teachers and providing leave under a year-round calendar, even though that approach required higher operational costs. The district had a choice of shifting dollars from air conditioning to instruction if it resumed a traditional calendar. It followed the odd stewardship decision of a board member who described $500,000 of savings as inconsequential, and that was in a time of a budget crisis. Our group moved our effort to the Capitol, and we learned that our state was paying for over 28 different school calendars, which prioritized the high utility rates of August over instruction, and that was even including schools who offer instruction less than 165 days. We should all ask what district calendar committees consider and prioritize when they set calendars. School districts serve our most vulnerable citizens. Some have disabilities. Seven of the Oklahoma cases at the Office of Civil Rights involved districts offering less than 165 days of instruction. I don't know the detail of the cases, but I can understand that children with disabilities can be adversely affected by a school day longer than 6 hours, a school week shorter than 5 days, and a school year shorter than 180. It affects the delivery of services. The executive director of special care in Oklahoma City gave me permission to share a few points. They provide after-school and programs for school breaks for children in grades 1 through 12 of at least 5 public school districts in our area. The majority of the students are on IEPs and come from single-parent families who work a traditional 5-day week, year-round job. When Oklahoma City changed to a year-round approach, its schedule deviated from these other districts, and it affected the ability for special care to serve the Oklahoma City families. They couldn't serve them. For the children served by special care, a longer school day, a 4-day week, would provide challenges in those students attending to task. Some may need additional medication, and most would need an afternoon meal or snack. Our kindergartners through 14-year-olds are also vulnerable citizens. Oklahoma's child labor laws set the minimum age for employment at 14 and limit 8-hour workdays. How is it that a 7 or 8-hour workday for school is good for children under the age of 14? School board members are also vulnerable citizens. I know from my Oklahoma City experience that they get pushed hard on advocacy from many directions. But I would point out that the statute used to set extended day schedules mandates that these boards revoke that calendar if improvement in student achievement is not documented. How many boards have had the courage to revoke the calendar after examining that information? Our state would benefit if our districts worked on similar schedules. It's time to refocus our children's needs for an appropriate length of school day and year, and the proposed rule is a good effort for this. Thank you for your service and listening to my perspective.
Thank you very much. We appreciate you being here. So I do know that there are possibly that was the only person that had signed up for public comment. And just to be very careful that we didn't miss someone that's unfamiliar with the need to sign up for public comment, I just want to pause for a moment in case someone else had intended to give that. All right, very good. At this time, we also have board members, some of our first-year superintendents that are with us under their statutory requirement to attend. And I want to acknowledge those who are here that signed up and also see if there was anyone here that we need to record their presence. From Colgate, Jack Ward, would you please stand? Thank you. Remain standing. Also from Rattan, Robert Ross. Is Robert here? Around the corner? Oh, you're in that spot where I can't see what you're doing. Okay, let's see. From Roland, we have Randy Martin. There you are. Thank you, Randy. From White Rock, Alicia Ebers, thank you. And from Peckham, Johnny Decker?
Decker.
I did say it right. Okay. Oh, that's a C. Now I see what I have. Have I missed anybody? All right, then. Thank you very much for your service and for being a first-year superintendent and taking on such a responsibility to be working with our schools. And we appreciate all the work that you're doing in these monthly meetings that you attend as well with those trainings. So appreciate you. Thank you. All right. Next item is our consent docket. Board members, please turn your attention to item number 6. Board members, there are a number of items here. Is there any item that you would like to discuss?
And particularly on item request A. I believe we have two individuals present today on the emergency certification portion.
Okay.
If they did not have a relevant degree or work experience pursuant to that guidance that we've seen in the last 2 months, those individuals are here before you today. I believe you have their resumes as well.
Okay. Yes.
On the where it's fiscal year to date by summary by area, so elementary education 513, are those the people that have to take the additional course?
Yes.
Okay, so all 513, other than the ones
right.
that we've already
Right. Am I correct?
Not necessarily on elementary. Certainly on early childhood. It's a grade range PK through 5.
Oh, that's right, from PK through 3 this year, right? And 5 for next year?
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes.
Thank you. Yes. Thank you.
Okay.
Yes, and for those who don't remember, we are requiring any emergency certified teacher this year, pre-K through 3rd grade, next year, pre-K through 5th grade, to go through the training. We are providing letters training, which is the science of reading. And it's quite comprehensive, and we won't renew any of their certificate if they do not meet that by the timeline set. And that is something that we have seen many teachers beyond those that are emergency certified also utilizing this training, which is free.
I got a question on B and C.
Okay.
I guess we've covered them all now. So.
Sure. What is your question?
On these waivers, you know, that's our transparency portal for the public. And when that information was due September 1, mm-hmm. and I understand a small school district. But there's a large school district in here too, mm-hmm. and it's important that information be as complete as possible all the time, and be able to. And some of this runs out until December. At what point does it start hampering the department from doing its function, and at what point does it hinder our reporting upstream, because we use this data all the time, and it prevents us from doing our job on a timely basis. So that's my question. No specific other than there's one in here in December, and September 1st was the due date on it.
Mm-hmm. Ms. Black, would you like to come to the podium, please? Come to the podium so we can have it on the recording. Thank you. For the audio record.
Excellent. You? Yeah.
Thank you.
And please introduce yourself.
My name is Catherine Black. I'm the Executive Director of OCAS Financial Accounting and Auditing. The September 1st deadline, all the districts should have their data uploaded and locked revenue and expenditures. We don't make that information available on the transparency website till we've had a chance to review it. But districts are required to meet that September 1 deadline. And that's what the penalty or the waivers are all about, is them not meeting that deadline. And then, according to administrative rule, We have up until December 15th to make any changes to that data. So it doesn't actually go out till the end of December, December 31st.
Thank you.
Sure.
Can I ask, on most of them, I mean, it seemed like the reason that they were late and were late only 1 month, by and large, was because someone retired or something along those lines, which I'm guessing is, you know, somewhat normal. On Gans Public Schools, it looked like they've been late 3 years in a row.
Yes.
Their application did not address why. They said why they were late this year, which they said was an internet issue, I guess, which seemed interesting to me. But do you have any idea why they've been late consistently for 3 years?
No, and we contact the district starting in August. I mean, we send out several notifications. Most of them, I think, were included in your packet. If we don't see that they've done anything by August 30th, we start calling and talking to the district and asking, you know, if they're having a problem, is there anything we can help with? And some of them do lock within that first week. I know there were two school districts that were having a lot of problems. Perry, for one, they had an internet issue where they had a ransom virus. So they had a lot of problems rebuilding all their data. And Lawton had changes in personnel that they were trying to clean up a lot of their data before they submitted.
Reasons why, or I don't know if you were here the last 2 years, but why they were late the last 2 years?
I think it was a lack of experience the first year, because I know I worked with that school district the first year. Last year, I don't really know why they were late last year, but then again this year, we have different financial specialists that are assigned different school districts, and they work with those school districts. And then as we get closer to the end, I get involved in calling and seeing what we can do. So.
And board members, to your question earlier and to Ms. Black's point, I think the information in your packet shows that the initial notification and follow-up to the districts started on August 19th and subsequently August 26th and then continued from there. So if that helps to answer your question about the notifications.
Can I ask, so on GANs specifically, like looking at the chart, like the FY19 OCAS finalized is blank. Does that mean that it hasn't been finalized still?
At the time of the report, it was probably not finalized. It probably wasn't done until December 16th because the 15th fell on a Sunday.
But there are several others that were finalized on the 16th.
GANs, if I'm remembering correctly, is their penalty a dollar?
No.
It's like okay, then I'm not really sure why there's not a date in there. I can get that date, certainly.
I was just curious if it meant something. Like
no.
So they're at a point that all final numbers are deemed to be final?
That would be December 15th, but again, since it was on a Sunday, we went to the 16th, so after close of business, we say 4:30, 5 o'clock on the 16th. The district nor SDE can make any changes to the data. Any other questions?
In the packet we received, Albion, I saw that there was an email response from the superintendent, but I didn't see everyone else provided a letter that said, here's why we missed it. Here's what we've done to correct it, and I did not see anything like that. Did we receive anything?
No, they didn't provide a letter, just the response to the email.
Okay.
Are there representatives here from any of these schools today?
That's a good question. I think I know Whitebead and Lawton, and there may be others. So is there a member that you would like to ask for specifically?
Albion. Gans and Perry would be the three that I would be interested in. Is anybody here from
either of all three of those? Anyone?
You are? Okay.
Okay, just because that was not on the mic, I'll say the answer was there was ransomware.
I'm sorry.
And that's identified in the letter requesting the waiver. I believe the ransom occurred in February of 2019.
February to December to get the data into the system?
Yeah, that's a good question.
Could you come to the microphone, please, from Perry?
Tom Pickens, assisting Perry on their school finance records. They had ransomware during the 18-19 year, and in trying to recover that, they had to rebuild all the records. They had to rekey all the data. At the same time, they had a change in treasurer. They retired during the year, and there was training that was involved with moving up one of the people that was working there in accounts payable, payroll, to take on those treasurer's duties along with the ransomware problem. So they were quite challenged.
All right.
Thanks. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Is it possible, what are the ramifications of, specifically on GANs, I think it would be helpful to better understand why they've been late 3 years, and it looks like in FY17 they were late all the way through December.
Mm-hmm.
Can we pull that one off and consider
yes.
it next month? And ask someone
certainly.
From GANs to
yes,
come
I believe that's possible.
Something?
I would like to confirm with Ms. Black, but I believe the penalty is imposed monthly on the state aid allocations, and so I might take that into consideration as well, whether.
So the
penalty continue 1% a month if we wait. We do not do a waiver this month. Is that what the?
It's on a scale. In the memo that was provided, it starts at 1%. Then the second month, the 2%. Third month, 3%, and up to 5%, which continues after that.
But since GANs has already have now since cleared it up, right? So it would just be the 1 month penalty.
Correct.
Okay.
I don't know, if I can just interject, I appreciate your, but I'm in my thinking, if there's a pattern there, I'm not sure what the root of the, so you're suggesting we just postpone them versus pull them out of the docket? I'm trying to
just
understand.
Pull GANs out so that we can, so we can either have them come and explain or submit some additional information as to why they were late for 3 years in a row and consider GANs specifically on the next docket. I mean, on the next month's agenda.
That's certainly possible if there's a motion.
If,
and
not, if there's not any.
I was going to actually recommend Albion and GANs be pulled out and decline on those
mm-hmm.
two and make a motion to approve the rest, but I was trying to understand what Jennifer was saying.
Mm-hmm.
So, anybody else have comments on that?
Would any approval, we would also take Wynette off, but I don't know that they even requested a waiver.
That's correct. They did not submit a request.
Okay.
So are they on here for the waiver then?
No, they're just on the list.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
All right.
I misspoke.
So I'd like
would you like to make that motion?
Yes, I would like to make a motion, if I may, to take off Albion and GANs, to decline on them, but then approve the rest of them.
All right. So then the motion is to honor the waiver request of all listed except for GAN and Albion.
That's correct.
In the consent docket.
Right. That's on portion B.
B.
B1 to be specific.
B1, item 8, when 1 and 8.
We can come back to A. As Mr. Flanagan pointed out, we can cover them all. Which would be question good. For you, Brad or Superintendent Hoffmeister, what happens if a district does not get a waiver? What is the next step? So if we vote no, what?
Then the penalty under law applies.
Okay.
Correct.
Monthly or just the month that it was due?
It's
a one-time
it's
fee.
One, depending on the depending on the payments that they were to receive for the rest of the year, to recoup that money depends on how much state aid they have coming. So if they have enough in state aid, it would come off of that next payment. If not, then it would come off the next two payments.
Got
three
it.
Payments.
So there would be a reflection in the state aid allocation at a monthly
in the monthly allocation until it's paid off.
Just want to note to the board that that does impact students and what they have in the classroom. So I understand that we want to strictly enforce the policies and procedures and think that we can do that through whether it's bringing them back to the board meeting, but state aid dollars do flow to classrooms, and I want to be mindful of what is impacting students.
I think, to me personally, I think giving them a month to come and justify why they, you know, I mean, instead of just outright, I mean, I'd be curious to hear what Gans has to say.
And what they're doing to not be here again next year, since this is the third year in a row.
Yeah. Because there were several that very, like I said, proactively, there are steps that they've taken to make sure that they're not in this place next year.
So, all right. Any other comments or discussion?
Can you speak to what those penalties will be specifically for those two schools?
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to search.
It's this table right here.
Yeah, it's not.
That's the one before that.
Oh, first
document was
2186.
Looks like.
And Albion was $327.
Yeah, Albion's $327.
Okay. $327 and Gans.
$2,186.
$2,186.
And 86,
yes, ma'am. I second that motion.
Okay. So we have a motion to approve the waivers with the exception of
Albion
and Gans. Gans, excuse me.
Second.
Oh, we have a second already.
Sorry.
So we have a motion, proper second. Any other comments or questions? All right. Please call the roll.
Ms. Hernandez?
Aye.
Mr. Ballenbach?
Aye.
Ms. Williams-Bradley?
No.
Mr. Flanagan?
Yes.
Mr. Bobek?
Yes.
Ms. Menes?
Yes.
Superintendent Hoffmeister?
Yes. Board members, there are other items on the consent docket.
Do we need to do the waivers on A? Do we need to actually interview those people?
They are present. If the board has questions for those individuals, they are here.
Short presentation by each proponent. Mm-hmm. I think that's the practice we've
all right
exercised so far on A.
So it's Laura Gonzalez.
All right.
Are these people who didn't take the letters training, or are these people?
No, they did not have the relevant degree or work experience for those grade ranges that we mentioned earlier about PK through 3.
Okay.
And the letters training was not, is a part of that, and they
correct
have not
it
done
will,
that.
It will be.
It will right be. They haven't
okay
had the opportunity to do that
okay
yet. Okay. All right. Is Laura Gonzalez here?
And Ms. Gonzalez, the request is from Little Axe Public Schools.
From Little Axe. All right. Ms. Gonzalez, would you come to the podium?
I think the district is here too.
I think the district is also with you. Would you like to also come to the podium?
Sure.
Thank you. All right. Mr. Flanagan, what would you like
just
to
kind of give me a you know, summary, real quick summary of your, where we're at and what's your background and what you're doing now in the school system?
My work background, I did work at DHS for a little over a year. I was a child protective services specialist. Other than that, I don't have a lot of teaching experience, but for this first month, I have been in the classroom. They have a experienced teacher in there with me as like a mentor for me, and that has been extremely helpful.
Talk about your high school experience. What did you do in high school?
Yes, in high school, I did. For a semester, I was a teacher's aide for first grade through third grade.
What subjects are you teaching now?
In first grade?
Mm-hmm.
We have curriculum for language, reading, and math, but we do all of those, science and social studies.
I noticed on your on Little Axe's application, it has listed as references the special education teacher. Are you in the special education classroom?
I am not.
I noticed that you were the valedictorian at Bethel.
Yes.
When you graduated from high school. As you take that experience of being quite a committed student, how is that impacting what you do today?
I am able to set that standard for students to help them strive in the classroom.
Why did you choose to enter into education and teach? What drives you to do this work?
I love speaking with kids and teaching them these new things. And along the way, they teach me a lot. And some of the things that they say kind of catch me off guard, like, oh, whoa, you're thinking about that? I just love it.
That's all I
have. Do you intend to kind of go through the process and get your full certification?
I do.
And continue in teaching?
Yes.
And that is the commitment of an emergency certified grantee. So, okay, very good. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We'd like to also ask for Erica Hicks. If Erica Hicks is with us today, thank you, Erica. And is
Tulsa
Public Schools also with you? All right, thank you.
Hello.
Hello.
Welcome. Can you tell us a little about yourself?
My name is Erica Hicks. As previously mentioned, I am originally from Colorado Springs, Colorado, but I've lived in Tulsa off and on since 2005. I went to ORU. I got my first bachelor's in social work in 2010. And I've been in between social work and education. Mm-hmm. I went home to Colorado for about 4 years where I did social work, but I also subbed. And I received my substitute certification in 2011, and I did that until 2014. And then I came back to Tulsa and did work with CPS and Child Protective Services, and then I taught at Debra Brown for 2 years.
Excellent. Very good. Well, we're glad you came back to Oklahoma.
Thank you.
Has the school district provided you some additional assistance in the classroom?
Yes, sir. I have a coach.
I can speak to that. Jabari Shume, thank you, Board and Superintendent. I serve as Executive Director of the MetCares Foundation, and the Greenwood Leadership Academy is a partnership school with Tulsa Public Schools, meaning that we are part of that district, but the district contracts with a nonprofit, which I'm the Executive Director of, that operates GLA. And so her instructional coach wasn't able to be with her, but her coaching consists of literally daily coaching. So there's always at the beginning of the week a one-on-one interaction with the coach. Observations and feedback follow that day, and as well as the second day of the week, the third week, they have a chance to have dialogue, and at the end of the week, kind of game plan and set strategy for next week. So she's under continuous coaching with our instructional coach in the school.
Thanks.
All right, very good. Thank you very much.
I have a question in regard to, it was mentioned we had a question as to Ms. Hicks was here because she didn't have the requisite prior experience. What is that standard? Because I noticed she has some, for a teacher for how long?
Yeah, this is on me, quite honestly. I did not catch this. I should have caught it, but Mrs. Hicks is here. And so I thought the opportunity, okay, since she took the time, I do apologize for that. I should have caught this, but that's
you can thank me later.
Hey, the minutes were wild. That's fine.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Hicks.
All right. Is there a other questions that you have on the remaining consent docket?
The Seminole deal. Can we just get a brief summary? Since that's such a big number, I think we need to make that part of the record and discussion on it, but... So Brad, can you kind of update us how this happened and why the waiver is appropriate and within our authority as this board?
Yeah, and I do believe we have a representative from the Academy of Seminole here if the board has questions. Very generally, this penalty is in the state aid section of the Title 70 of the Oklahoma statutes. If a school district has per pupil revenue and expenditures above a certain threshold, then
there is an offset, and that offset is that that district shall not receive state aid. The theory, I believe, is that if they have an ad valorem base, so we're talking districts off the formula, then the theory is that that district should not be receiving state aid. This Academy of Seminole, we were talking about OCAS a moment ago, input their data December 16th, I believe it was locked and certified, which was the allowable time. Once that happens, then that information goes to the state aid office. They review this information to impose or not impose a penalty, as provided in that section of law. Under the board's general waiver authority, there's a waiver for this request, and that is the basis for the request.
The fact is they didn't receive any ad valorem tax, and that's normally the
correct.
What that is
triggers
correct.
This ad valorem or growth production tax is not.
That is correct. I believe due to the growth of the school from 1 year to the current year, there was a need to acquire additional facilities to educate the students in. And so without receiving the local ad valorem tax base and totally relying on state aid, that school made the decision to privately fundraise dollars. And that's where the additional revenue came from.
And that has to do with coding, and once it was locked, we couldn't unlock it. And
correct.
So
but it was timely filed.
And it was just like an accounting error on putting on the wrong line item, basically?
I'll defer to Ms. Black. I do not believe it was an error. I believe it was accurately put in as private revenue. Local revenue, but the ability is there to request the waiver, and so they're requesting that waiver.
Basically, the local community stepped up, provided dollars outside of the tax base, and by doing that, under this scenario, they would be penalized.
That is correct.
Okay.
All right. Are there any other questions on anything on the consent docket?
Yeah. I make a motion we approve all consent items as presented.
Very good. Any second? All right. That's motion. Proper second. Is there any other questions or discussion?
Should that just be 6A and 6C? We've already approved
yes,
sir.
Some
it
amendments,
yeah.
6B.
All right. Call the roll, please.
Ms. Moniz?
Aye.
Mr. Bobek?
Aye.
Mr. Flanagan?
Yes.
Mr. Ballenbach?
Aye.
Ms. Williams-Bradley?
Aye.
Ms. Hernandez?
Aye.
Superintendent Hoffmeister?
Aye. Thank you very much. All right. Board members, thank you. Turn your attention to item 7, which is the annual report on alternative ed. This is going to be a very brief presentation by those who work in our Office of School Support. If you'll please come to the podium, Petra, and introduce yourself.
Good morning, Superintendent Hoffmeister and honorable members of the board. Thank you for having us here today.
And both of you, introduce yourself.
Yes. I am Petra Woodard. I'm the Executive Director of Academic Counseling here in the agency in the Office of Student Support under the leadership of Dr. Shelley Ellis, who is our Deputy Superintendent. I have 27 years of experience, all at the secondary level, most recently out of the principal seat at Millwood High School. I have with me here Braden Savage.
Braden? I'm the director of Alt-Ed, started with the department at the end of October. I came by way of Western Heights. I was the former assistant superintendent there, 25 years in
Excellent.
Education.
Well, we are grateful you're both here. Thank you.
Thank you.
And if we can get the report up.
Yes.
Thank you.
And while they're doing that, we also have with us here Missy Korn, who is our field specialist.
Thank you,
Missy. And Missy has over 20 years experience in just alt-ed, and so she's a great resource for us. Thank you for having us here to present the alternative education report for school year 2019. They said there's a clicker, and here it is. We're just going to do a brief overview and present the data for last year. Again, that is our staff in the alternative education department. I'm going to turn it over to Braden, who is going to do a overview because we've done some restructuring in the department, and she's going to talk to you about that as well as an overview of alternative education.
Miss the
So, like I said, I joined the department at the end of October. I feel like I jumped in, hit the ground running, and that's what I'm going to do here and just try to give you an overview of what our office does and also what Alt-Ed is all about and what qualifies to make an Alt-Ed program. First off, how we have things divided up. There are three of us in our office, and Petra is the one that's here in-house, and then Missy and I are out and about around the state, and we have the state divided into regions, and those regions, the northern half of the state, Missy pretty much covers that, where I cover the southern half. I'm getting to learn my southern Oklahoma geography for sure. We're out and about. We're making sure that we go through the rubric to make sure that districts, their programs are meeting the requirements of law. What makes an alt-ed program? We do a student interview, so we do talk to students, and we are going through a checklist of documentation that we have to see from those districts. Another thing that we're doing is we're trying very hard. We're going out and we're looking for compliance, making sure that, programs are following the law, but we are also wanting to provide supports where districts need that extra support. And in that, we are striving to have better communications between the offices here at the State Department. And so that means working with the Office of Accountability, the Special Ed Office, the Office of School Supports, and others to make sure that we're streamlining that and giving the most supports to districts that we can. And here is, this map will show you the regions that we have. Again, Missy's taking that north half, and I've got the southern half. And to look at an overview of what is an alt-ed program, what does an alt-ed student look like? These are going to be our students most at risk of not completing high school, not getting their high school diploma. And it can be for all sorts of different reasons. It may be because of a health issue, whether that be a physical or mental health issue. It may be because of their home life. They are actually a breadwinner for their family, and they have to work all the time. That keeps them out, and then they're missing school the next day. So a lot of times it's attendance issues. They may be taking care of younger siblings. They may be a pregnant or parenting student. So there's a whole host of reasons why it puts them in a situation where they're at risk to not graduate. What makes an alt-ed program? They have to have, by law, they have to have these 16 components, and I'm just going to go through those quickly. This is what's included on our rubric and our checklist to make sure that programs are meeting these requirements. The first one is that student-teacher ratio, and it has to be at least 15 to 1 or less, so it creates that smaller size so that teachers can be more focused on individual students and their needs. And number two is the appropriate structure and curriculum. Basically, that just means it should not look like just a regular high school classroom. Obviously, that wasn't meeting their needs before. So many programs will use an online curriculum that is very individualized to meet those needs of the students, what coursework that they need. And then programs will watch and monitor students and see if there's any extra assistance that they need to give. Number three is they have to have an intake and screening process, and that just means they have to make sure that they're looking at all the data, looking at the students' grades, their attendance, their progress towards getting their credits to graduate, and then bringing in regular classroom teachers, the administrator, counselor, the alternative ed teacher and director, having input from all those people plus the student and the parents as well. Number four would be obviously needing a certified teacher, appropriately certified teacher in that spot, but even more importantly, a teacher who has success with students who are at risk. It does take a teacher who's going to be a little bit more understanding, although still hold them to those high expectations and making sure that they're staying on track to get their credits in. Number six would be collaboration with state and local agencies. We want to make sure these are at-risk students, so they have lots of needs, and we need the community, the surrounding community, to be invested as well. And this can be collaboration with the food bank in the area, might be the health department, OSU Extension, the Career Techs, all of those entities coming together and surrounding these students that are most at risk. Number eight would be individualized. Number seven is the making sure that the program meets the state standards. Eight, individualized instruction, because again, they're going to come in at all different places and need different coursework in order to graduate, plus those at-risk needs that they have would appear to be different as well. Number nine is the clear and measurable program goals. They must have those in place. 10 is counseling and social service components, and this would be in addition to the high school counselor, which should be coming in at least once a week to serve the needs in that program, but also outside counseling agencies do come in and provide those extra supports for students. And sometimes in some places that is more than one counseling agency coming in. Number 11 is that graduation plan for each student. Upon intake, they should be going over the graduation plan on what it's going to take for them to get their credits in to graduate. But then it needs to be reviewed on a regular basis with the director teacher in the program, but also the students and the parents too. So the student is being held accountable for that, and everybody's in the know on them staying on track to graduate. Number 12 is a life skills component. There must be life skills instruction involved, and that would be on a regular basis. This is just because we're not just wanting them to leave the program having graduated. We also want them to have a plan for success in life, and we want them to be contributing great members of society and to give them these life skills that will help prepare them. That can be anything from learning to balance your checkbook to changing a tire. There are sewing classes that I've seen out there, cooking, all kinds of life skills there. The number 13 is opportunities for arts education, and that's in addition to what would just be credit for coursework. It would be those extra opportunities to have that creative outlet, to show these students that are most at risk that there are ways of handling stress that would be in a creative way. So having those opportunities, plus the fact that it also helps them come together in a cooperative learning type setting. Number 14 is the annual budget. We do require an annual budget, which shows how they're using those allocated funds. And one thing that I have definitely seen in my short time is being out there, what's being allocated, most all districts are spending much more than what's being allocated for Alt-Ed. When you think about the personnel that they're investing, the money that it takes for those seats for the online platforms and the other things that they bring in for those most at-risk students. Number 15 shows that the service to student would be in grades 7 through 12, and that has changed from previous legislation, which was 6 through 12. And number 16 is the opportunities for the students to participate in those regular activities that they would be able to if they were in the regular high school program, as long as they are eligible to do those.
Thank you for that. And I know that you have some additional slides that have a lot of data on them, and we won't go through all of those.
Okay.
So you have those, board members. Of the remaining slides with some of the graphs, what would be one slide that you think would be the most helpful for some additional conversation so the board members can ask questions?
You have all of the program number datas and the separation mm-hmm. of schools. Something that we wanted to highlight would be the graduation and dropout rate.
Uh-huh.
We do have wanted to make sure that it looks like the number of graduates have dropped, but that is because the number of 9th and 10th graders, we're serving a large number of those students. And so we're having the students graduate because the dropout rate has reduced, and also the number of students who have re-engaged in the program are coming back. They had over about 100 students to drop out and then come back and decide to get those additional credits.
That's great news.
And just one other was this one. We talked mm-hmm. about the career tech for post-secondary opportunities. The same thing, we're just watching those lower number of students who are coming in, and it looks like that career tech in concurrent enrollment and internships are down, but that's because the number of students who are eligible for those programs are not there, because they're mostly 9th and 10th grade, and those programs, you particularly have to be 11th grade, but their work study and service learning opportunities have increased. And so we're really proud, because overall it looks like the students who are going to the all-day programs are remaining engaged in school in some type of way.
All right, and could you show that slide number 19, please? And tell us a little bit about this as a final slide.
The credit deficiency?
Mm-hmm.
So we want to track the number of students who don't graduate just simply based on credits, and so not some of those other factors, attendance or they have to work or whatever, but the number of students who are deficient just in credits, and that number is dropping. And so the students are being served better in the programs in order to work with the schools to decide what credits that they need, so they're really focused on getting the appropriate supports and curriculum so that those students can finish. And we believe that we're going to watch this number to look for our 5-year, 6-year, and 7-year mm-hmm. cohorts. Mm-hmm. And so those graduation rates should improve for those students as well.
That's really good news. And we know there's so much work being done, and that ICAP is also a real important component of helping our students stay in a course that has a wide pathway for lots of options without falling off that course, and is also an opportunity for those who never envisioned what happens after high school. And so this piece, your discussion around mental health supports is also so very important, and we think about Alt-Ed as truly what exemplifies meeting kids where they are. And then being able to help them to have a vision and have eyes for what they might not be able to see. And we know there's so many great people that you get to work with that are doing that work out in Oklahoma schools, and we really appreciate that.
Absolutely.
Board members, are there any questions that you have?
On the one teacher for 15, is that holding pretty steady at statewide, or is there exception? There's no single factor that will... Is the 15, 1 to 15, is that holding statewide, or is it a little bit less than that? Or
I would say that most programs it's a little bit less than that. However, it's right about the 15 number.
And that proves to be a good number?
Yes.
Okay.
Smaller programs obviously will have a little bit less numbers, but they stick with that 1 to 15.
All right.
Go ahead.
More, yes.
The numbers that you had shown us on the various statistics, I assume those break down by school. Do we have an ability to break those down by school?
We do have that information.
So
that they turn in.
We're asked on a fairly regular basis to give waivers to the consolidation requirement on Alt-Ed programs. In the future, would we be able to pull some of that data and include those with the applications? What I often find are some applications are very thorough. The school will provide a lot of statistics. I think you often find a lot of educators who tend to not, they feel like they're bragging if they're telling you all the great things they're doing. And I think a lot of times we get applications that don't have the adequate data behind it for us to say, yes, we are going to waive the statutory requirement. But I think the numbers could help us a lot. So would it be something that we could do is, in coordination maybe with Mr. Piper, is provide kind of an overview of the data behind a school's program?
Yes, we do collect end-of-year summary data for each site, and what we did this year in particular is combine all that data by school, and then we also have the summary data so that we can actually look, and if they're on the road, they can kind of snapshot and say this is what was reported previously and this is what's been done, so that we can monitor that by school as well.
Okay, because obviously if there's a school that has a very successful program, we don't want to disrupt that and we would want to grant waivers if we're able to, and if there's one that maybe isn't quite as successful, maybe it is a need for consolidation. So that might be able to help us in our decision making.
Very good.
Thank you.
And you may have this answer. Now, with the data and the student outcome from alternative education, does that also go into the statewide performance?
Yes, and together? So that so builds toward, remember, in our school accountability dashboard, for the first time, we are able to offer not just recognition for the four-year cohort graduation, which, of course, we want all of our students, if possible, to graduate under those federal requirements of a four-year cohort graduation and on time. But we're recognizing that additional work districts are doing with a fifth-year and a sixth-year cohort. And so that's reflected for the first time in our school report cards. And that incentivizes our schools to continue to work with both special education students that need that sixth year before they age out to stay in and receive services, as well as those who have left and we want to see them come back and finish in the fifth year or sixth.
And we have some districts, larger districts, that actually have a component of virtual school mm-hmm. within those larger districts. Are those considered alternative education for now? Those virtual school components?
Yes, they definitely are using a virtual opportunity for credit recovery and some other aspects you want to speak to?
They would be considered if they're meeting the 16 components. So if they're getting those life skills lessons in there, if they've got that art component in. So as long as they're meeting that legislation, those 16 components, then they can be considered an alt-ed program and go into those alt-ed numbers.
And that now, is likely.
There are some places that do have separate virtual programs as well, but in order to be alt-ed, they have to follow that.
Yeah. Very good. I believe it's about 13,000 students in alternative education.
Mm-hmm. Could you go back to slide 14 for just a second? I want to give you all an accolade here because I'm a big proponent of alternative pathways and multiple pathways. And when you look at career tech, you look at internships, work study, credit, this is fantastic. So I encourage you, please continue to give those kids opportunities. And I think it's great, the work you're doing. So thank you for that.
All right. Well, thank you to the whole team. And we appreciate your work. And we appreciate you being here to tell us about it today.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Thank you, board members. Item number 8A is discussion and possible action on the Tulsa Teacher Corps application submitted by Tulsa Public Schools to be a provider of an alternative teacher preparation program under state statute that is relatively new. Yep. Welcome. I think we have some of those from Tulsa Public Schools. Please come to the podium and introduce yourselves.
Good morning, Board Member Superintendent Hoffmeister and board members. My name is Devin Fletcher. I am the Chief Academic and Chief Talent Officer for Tulsa Public Schools.
Good morning, board member, as well as superintendent and those in attendance. My name is Quentin Liggins. I am the Director of Talent Acquisition, Retention, and Development for Tulsa Public Schools, and it's an honor to be before you today.
Thank you.
So we are here to talk about the Tulsa Teacher Corps, which has been a labor of love for the last couple of years. Tulsa Teacher Corps started out of a need and a desire to serve our students in Tulsa Public Schools in a space where we had significant teacher shortages. We worked with TNTP and wrote a joint grant application to receive federal dollars in order to build a comprehensive teacher development program in Tulsa Public Schools. And so that's why we're here. We'll give a little context about who we serve in Tulsa because I think it's incredibly important. We serve approximately 40,000 students in Tulsa Public Schools. We employ about 6,500 employees. We have 76 schools, a large majority of those being elementary schools, comprised of our six charter partners. And then we have about 2,300 educators that we serve within Tulsa.
So as you can see before you on the screens, our vision is for Tulsa to be the destination for extraordinary educators. Our superintendent and our leadership team, including Mr. Fletcher, created a bold strategic plan, Destination Excellence, and we focus on not only being the best district in Oklahoma, but also the best district in the country. We are grounded in five core values, but we also have certain expectations of everyone who works in Tulsa Public Schools, that is to be a learner, a contributor, and a designer. A little bit about our students. Tulsa Public Schools is a diverse urban school district. As you can see, we have a great representation, not only of the diversity of Tulsa Public Schools and the Tulsa greater community, but also the United States. So for us, it's a microcosm of the greatness of our country, and it provides us an opportunity to meet all of our students, no matter their diverse backgrounds, where they are, to show them that they can achieve in this great state of Oklahoma.
So Tulsa Public Schools has set out on this endeavor with Tulsa Teacher Corps, and our ultimate goal was to train individuals who were connected to Tulsa to serve in Tulsa. One of the things that we know is that bringing individuals into an urban environment, we wanted to make sure that they had context for where they were serving, an understanding of the students they were serving, and a commitment to being in the community in which they were serving. And so that's the reason why Tulsa brought Tulsa Teacher Corps together. As I stated, we started in earnest in the fall of 2017. We received notice that we got the grant in October, and then sprinted really fast to begin the first cohort in the summer of 2018. We did a ton of work with our partner, TNTP, within the district to build the program and to set our first cohort underway. Within that first year, we had not only had to develop the 6 weeks curriculum, plan for the year-long development that would happen thereafter, but also to recruit talented individuals who were committed to starting a program that was brand new. And now we're in our second year.
So as the member of Tulsa Public Schools who had the great honor to launch this initiative, one thing we wanted to make sure we were grounded in as we begun our work is guiding principles. You can't know where you're going unless you know what you stand for. And for us, this is what we stand for as we think about serving our diverse students and how we make design decisions within the district and within the program. It is important that we center our students, but we also take care of our adults. Happy, whole people can help educate happy, whole students. And for us, as we move forward, to continue to design our two-year arc of programming and hopefully with your approval expand the types of teachers we educate, these core guiding principles beyond our values are going to be part and parcel to how we make all of our decisions.
So as part of the work that we had to do, we had to develop a really comprehensive program to ensure that we are meeting the standards that were set forth by national accreditation standards and the state of Oklahoma. And so in earnest, that's what we've done. As you can see here, and maybe you cannot, one of the things that we wanted to do is think about core components that built on learning expectations in the learning environment, making sure that we focus on skills development and having a comprehensive standards-aligned curricula for our educators. Within that, we took the core components of what's required by national accreditation standards as well as state accreditation standards and built core curricula that focused in six-week increments in the summer, but then built a two-year arc of learning over the course of a core member's experience.
So as you can see before you, we have an arc of learning that entails the entire school year. That includes one-on-one coaching, in-person professional development sessions, online coursework, and then optional sessions that take place. As Devin mentioned, we focused our Tulsa learning expectations on the Oklahoma state standards, and want to be very clear about how we're developing people in accordance with the state as it relates to being a professional educator here in the state of Oklahoma, and then also ensuring that they are grounded in our curricula so they are able to make wise academic choices when they're in front of students who have diverse needs, and providing support through in-person coaching as well as online learning as well.
I think what's incredibly important is that Oklahoma academic standards set a really rigorous bar. And so we took the Oklahoma academic standards and morphed them into what we call the Tulsa Way. One of the things was really important for us is to have a really stamped identity of what it means to teach in Tulsa, because we are unique in many ways. We serve a very diverse set of students, and we wanted to have a brand that our teachers knew and understood what was important to us. One of the things is setting that bar high, and making sure that we have aligned resources for our teachers, because we know that we have a significant number of novice educators coming in, and we wanted to create an opportunity for them to have a strong entry into the classroom. And that starts with grounding in high-quality curricula, strong adult learning, and consistent coaching to follow up along the way. And so we built a program that really, really anchors them in what it means to teach, not only at the bar set by the state, but within Tulsa Public Schools.
So as we move towards our recommendation, which we hope to be before you, recommending individuals for certification as a portion of completing their program, completing the required testing that the state has, but then also going through our rigorous program, this would be a model portfolio that you all would have to review, the online coursework transcripts, looking at the pre-service training performance. To pass our program, you have to pass a rigorous evaluation through in the summer to be recommended to move forward to teach our students. We take it very seriously, stewarding Tulsa Public School students and ensuring that they have individuals in front of them who not only represent the communities in which they serve, but can hold a high bar of excellence and help students achieve that bar. Classroom evaluations, professional development, coaching session, all the notes and things that will be a part of this person's portfolio, certification examinations, as I mentioned, and lesson plans and how we've scored them in their way. So we will come before you many times, hopefully, with individuals who have met our bar and be able to show you that their work has not only been rigorous, but they've also met and achieved with our students.
So as we think about why we are here before you, the reason that we are here is that we see a significant number of emergency certified teachers that come through Tulsa Public Schools, as well as across the state. Our ultimate goal was to reduce the number of emergency certified teachers within Tulsa, to ensure that we're focusing on training and developing high quality educators that are going to be in front of each and every one of our students, and ensuring that we work towards retaining the educators that come before us. What we know is that as we as educators are coming in, they're emergency certified over the arc of the two-year window. If they have not met the requirements that are outlined to become standard certificate educators, they leave us. So we've invested significant amount of dollars in their professional development over time, relationships with our students, more importantly, and integrating them into our staff, and then they leave us. So this is an opportunity for us to create a stopgap, but one that actually works. And so we are in our first year, and what we know is that we're retaining on par with our novice educators at the same level. What this will do for us, I believe, is give our Tulsa Teacher Corps members an understanding that they are important, that they've got a pathway to certification, and a reason to stay with us long term. And so it's an anchor for us to help keep them. So we're here for today to ask for your support in getting there. And we want to ensure that we're able to offer our Tulsa Teacher Corps members a standard certificate after they've completed the requirements that have been set forth. We want to ensure that we've asked for a waiver of the collegiate hours that they need for the additional coursework. And the reason we're asking for that is because one of the things that we know is that educators who are coming in often face significant challenges financially that prevent a barrier for them to continue their work. We have created a robust program that encompasses the requirements that have been set forth by the state and national standards, and believe that we can meet that bar and show it through their preparedness in completing the certification examinations and their progress in the classroom. that would eliminate a hurdle for our educators and create an opportunity for us to ensure that they become standard certificated individuals along the way. And so we are excited to be here and ready and willing to answer any questions that you all may have.
Thank you very much for that presentation. It's really exciting to see how Tulsa is working to really tackle a really important need with high quality, well-trained educators and that work that's so important in classrooms. Board members, do you have questions or comments?
How do you adjust the program for specific subject matter in classroom? Because you're going to have a complete curriculum of matter, and so how do you adjust it to each individual instructor?
So in the current state, we focused on specifically elementary, and so we've built out a comprehensive set of resources that help to support pre-K through fifth grade. And the reason we focus there is because that's the area where we've got the most significant and most immediate need. And those are the areas where if we get it right on the front end, then we know that we can sustain and ensure that we're closing some of the gaps that we see later. As we are working for middle and secondary, middle and high school, we are building out specific subject matter criteria based on our needs. And so we know that there is a high need in content areas such as math and science at the secondary level. That's like our next endeavor.
So elementary and early education, that corresponds to our data here through the state system. It's the same group of people. And so your population is correct.
Yes, sir.
And we're also before you today to talk about expanding, and we've begun the work in the application, as you'll see, to special education for services to our elementary school students. So weaving in the content that is required by boot camp to ensure that educators who are going to work with our most vulnerable population have an opportunity to be grounded in what it takes to be successful with those individuals, but also have a high bar of academic excellence in helping them achieve. So leveraging what the state has put together so thoughtfully and putting it with our Tulsa Teacher Corps programmatic arc, and making sure that those who would come to us and want to teach special education students have the appropriate training to do so.
And the reason we believe that is so incredibly important because it focuses on preparing them to support exceptional students, as well as being strong content-driven instructors, meaning that our regardless of where our students are, they're receiving strong tier one instruction, which we know has been a consistent gap.
So let's just talk. Oh, go ahead. I'll defer to board members first. Ms. Moniz.
Thank you for being here. And just to kind of say, you know, I think teacher professional development is so critical throughout teaching. And so you have a very robust program that I believe is seeing results. And so thank you for bringing this application to us. I had some questions specifically about the application, just as far as like kind of how teachers progress through the program and like kind of the check marks that they have to meet. One of the metrics it talks about as far as at the end of year one that teachers have to meet, like student performance data is one of those metrics. It didn't go into detail as far as like what kind of student performance data, or maybe it did later and I missed it, but can you talk about what that looks like and how teachers prove they've met kind of the student performance data check mark as that criteria after year one?
So within each of our schools, we use MAP, the measure of assessed progress for our schools. And for each one of our educators and within each school that they serve in, there is a bar that is set based on what their expectations are for students to meet or exceed their projected growth percentiles. And so we set bars for each student and the teachers in terms of the cohorts of students they serve. We evaluate that data and look and see what percentage of their students have met or exceeded their goals, as well as we look at their where they are in terms of students' social and emotional well-being as measured by we used to use Tripod and we've since switched, but we look at that to see how have students rated the teacher
as the survey.
As the survey, Have they built a sense of belonging? How are they managing with students' emotional and social well-being in the classroom? And then how are they progressing in terms of ensuring that students are meeting and making academic progress? And so there's a kind of a multi-layered approach that we have to ensure that there's a body of evidence to support them continuing.
One thing that we did not highlight in our formal presentation is our sustainability of the program model. And we have had the great fortune to work with TNTP, and we received the $5 million grant over the arc of 3 years. What the beautiful thing about the way we built our internal capacity is that we are prepared to take on this work moving forward without TNTP support. They have scaled down every year in supporting us. Those who are providing the professional development are educators in our system, school leaders in our system. So they're getting to learn from the people that they will work with. And then also it has built the content knowledge, and it's provided us not only a pathway for our novice educators to see themselves growing in the district, but also a retention pathway for our instructional mentors, those individuals who are school leaders, to help them shape the next generation and stay with us. So it's important for us to note that we are prepared to move this work forward internally, that it's not grant dependent, and it'll be a great opportunity for us to continue to grow our own in Tulsa.
And that was, if I can have a follow-up question. Mm-hmm. On that, because that was one of, on the coaching model specifically, I mean, I just want to praise the model because it talked about the coaches meet at least once every 2 weeks with kind of their novice teachers, which I think is great. Can you talk about, like, do your coach teachers, do they get paid more? Like, what, I mean, that sounds very intensive on the coaching side as well. Like, how does that look?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, so we've made shifts to our coaching model to ensure that our move our coaches to 12-month positions. So our coaches have an opportunity, one, where they're continuing to receive adult learning, and that is on a weekly basis. So we pull our coaches weekly to ensure that they're like learning and growing and practicing, and then they're working with their cohorts of teachers the remainder of the week, the other four and a half days of the week. And so we move them 12 months so that they have an opportunity to continue to learn. So that's the first, so the move from a teacher salary schedule to 12 month ensures that we do pay them more, but then it gives us an opportunity to make sure that we're continuing to grow them as well. And then they are in turn working with the cohort of teachers in the summer for the 6-week cycle. So they're building relationships, mm-hmm. working alongside of them as they're in the classroom, getting an understanding of like their strengths and opportunities early, and then creating the plans that they will use throughout the year to help coach and develop them in those cycles.
Go ahead, Carlisha, please.
Well, first of all, I love the model. I think that one of the core components to teachers staying in the classroom is receiving professional development. I also really enjoy the approach to build a teacher cohort that's reflective of the students that we serve. I do have one question. You mentioned these other aspects of special education or specialized support in creating a program for math. Have you all started that work alongside TNTP, or would that be something emerging later if approved here?
We've started the work with TNTP, and so the whole point of having the three-year grant was really to build the program in a way that once they're leaving us, which is intentional, that we've built an intentional transition points. And for us, the major focus area was early education, and so and then the other place that has a significant need for us is special education. And so those are two areas that we've built alongside of TNTP.
Okay, I have a question since we're on the topic of special education. So once a special education candidate completes the program, what assurance is there that they understand how to write an effective IEP and to be able to give and provide direct instruction?
So you can, as outlined in our application, you'll see the arc of learning for our special educators. And in that arc of learning is the core components that what you would receive in boot camp. And so those things are being very intentionally woven in and to ensure that they have the prerequisite skills to be able to do that at the conclusion of their programming. So want to be sure that we are acknowledging the great work that is outlined, that is in boot camp, but then making sure that the content, as Devin mentioned, and the high expectations for all students are there. So it is part and parcel to the boot camp requirement.
But they don't.
Yes.
Okay. They'd also, so specific to what would we be able to do to ensure that they're writing, capable of writing, strong and sound IEPs. One, I think there are a couple of things. They'd be paired with and working alongside educators who are certificated and being trained by their peers, having an opportunity to, in many cases, co-teach and learn through modeling and peer mentorship. And then as part of a body of evidence, we'd be working with them along the arc of the period of development so that they are practicing alongside their peers and having it juried by our staff and team.
So what I hear you saying, and for board members that aren't familiar with the term boot camp, this is a training, a set of specific components that go into training provided at the State Department of Education for such candidates, that you would be embedding that work. Is that the assurance that you're
that
giving?
That is.
Okay. Other questions?
Superintendent, can I
ask
a question? And we've worked and read the application along the way. My question surrounds the competency examinations that are required for certification. I saw on, I think it was a previous slide, the request number two is for a waiver of the general education test.
Yeah, I saw that.
I thought I read in the application that that was going to be taken by the individuals. I do understand that there is a current waiver that's very
ACT.
Similar to this.
Yeah.
My question, just to conclude that, in the statute it requires an annual report. And that annual report is to have a breakdown of individuals who have passed the competency examinations and who have not passed. How do you plan to translate that if you have a waiver from the assessment?
So for those individuals who have taken the ACT, I believe it's in the last 15 years or something that have had the writing component, what we would have to do, and we'd work with you all, the initial thinking is to provide the copy of their score. I know they have to submit that now for current waivers.
Mm-hmm.
If the individuals per our application did not take the ACT within that time window, we have a broad range of individuals as it relates to the age, then they would still have to take the OGAT. And so that's why the way it's presented in the application is the default is you take the OGAT before we would ask for the waiver because it's we actually have more individuals who would have aged out of that potential to be able to do that. So that's how we would balance it, but would love to work in partnership on how we would submit for those younger teachers who may have taken the ACT and already fulfilled that requirement.
Thank you.
What is the district doing to help support and prepare those candidates for passing the required exams?
In general or within the Tulsa Teacher
However
Corps?
However you want to answer that. I'm curious for
both.
It's like, which way do you want me to go here? No. So from a district level perspective, just at broad, we offer development courses and opportunities on what we call Super Saturdays for any individual who has not taken and passed their requisite course examinations to join. Those are voluntary, and so we do have individuals who choose to come, and if they do, we provide supports to help them along the way and in preparation. For Tulsa Teacher Corps, it's not optional, and so we are requiring, as a byproduct of being part of this program, that you must attend. And then we're helping to grow you along the way.
Okay.
We've also set some benchmarks as a district to ensure that we're minimizing the number of emergency certification applications that continue to come back before you by setting really rigorous expectations that within the first semester they have registered for, regardless of if you're Tulsa Teacher Corps or not, and registered for and in many cases taken your first examination, because we want to ensure that you're not waiting to a point where you get to your end of year one or start year two and you have no way of completing all three examinations that are required before the end of your emergency cert. And so and the reason we're doing that is because it gives us an opportunity to, one, understand where individuals are and to provide more tailored and differentiated supports for them along the way. So if you take it, you don't pass, then we know, and then now we've got an opportunity to help you along the way so that you're not continuing to invest your dollars or your time in a way that doesn't actually benefit the outcome that you want to see.
I have two questions on this slide. On number four specifically, and I don't know if it's someone at the department that needs to answer this, as far as it being able to be retroactive beyond when the bill was actually passed and signed into law. I just don't know if it seems, I don't believe the bill allowed it to be retroactive or that that was included in the legislation. And so I was just curious, I don't know who would answer that question. If you guys know the answer or someone else,
I'll
that's
take a stab
even
at
allowable.
It. So to your point, the law does not specify that it's retroactive. At the same time, I believe that they've laid the groundwork to develop and implement the program if it's approved day one. So if an individual, for example, requirement number five is that the program offer intensive preparation before the teacher candidate assumes classroom responsibilities, if they have individuals that are employed with TPS right now and they can demonstrate that that individual is going to hit the ground with the intensive classroom preparation, then I think they can satisfy all those requirements.
I guess my question would be then, like, it looked like there were 73 members in the 2008 cohort and then 82 in the 2019 cohort. So are you asking for them, if they've gone, have they gone through the program, I guess the two-year program, and, like, are you asking for them to get certification through that?
Yeah, so it's the second number. We had our initial pilot number, which was the 73. That was a one-year program. Then, as you all know, the legislative cycle, we started the process, and individuals who we shared that this may be a possibility. There's no guarantee that we may, if there is a bill passed, that we have designed an arc for you that would be 2 years. So it would be that second number, the 82 number.
Okay.
With those individuals who want to continue on this journey, they're emergency certified now, but we would be able to show, like, the requirements that they've met for year one as it relates to this program, and then any subsequent people that we recruit. It was just that we wanted to provide somebody an opportunity.
So they've only gone through 1 year of the 2 year.
Yeah,
program.
They're in their kind of second semester, essentially, of the programmatic arc.
Okay.
Well, the need is great. Yeah. We know the need is great. And we want to hold on to individuals who have said, I am willing to step in and go through training to become fully certified. And so I applaud Tulsa simply taking this on themselves to really work to develop those who are willing to be a part of this, but to make sure that they are trained. So speaking to that, I have a question. So we're talking about elementary. We're also talking about students with high needs in special education. How does this program ensure that those candidates are being trained in the science of reading?
So that's incredibly important. And so one of the things that we are doing and have done, and so I think I applaud the state for the work that they're doing with letters and ensuring that every candidate that comes in henceforth will be required to have that. And so one thing we're thinking about is figuring out how we offer our own letters training within the district for our every one of our educators that are in elementary. But we've also adopted high-quality instructional materials that are grounded in evidence-based in the science of reading. We spend a significant amount of time in the early grades really focused on helping to develop our educators to understand because I think there's a misconception that once you go through your undergraduate years that you come out and you know how to teach students to read. And as you stated, it's a science. It requires really intentional focus and understanding the components and how they braid. And so we walk our educators through understanding, you know, phonemic awareness and phonological awareness and morphology, and really grounding their understanding, mm-hmm. helping them to understand the arc of teaching students to read, and then for those post bridging second to third grade, how students are really moving from, you know, learning to read to reading to learn. And that's been an intentional focus for us across the district. I think we've got a significant amount more work to do. And I think one of the areas that I'm excited about is having opportunities to continue conversations with our higher education institutions around preparation prior to educators coming into our systems, and being able to think about what are the things where we're seeing gaps. And so we have a step back that we do with surrounding universities every year. Okay. And these are the things that we're bringing up because we think there's a significant opportunity to focus on really building that learning before entering into the classroom. And in many ways, and we want to be as strong as partners as we can to make sure that that's happening. So.
Okay, so that was one of the questions I was going to have, is have you partnered with local teacher preparation programs in delivering the coursework? I'm thinking about what's right there with NSU, sure. Broken Arrow, University of Tulsa, Oral Roberts University. I mean, there are Langston University, I believe, as well. And so you have opportunities there to partner together. We know that many folks will step in, Teach for America, folks who have their bachelor's in another program and then end up getting a master's in education. And so this is not the traditional path into colleges of education, yet I would love to see, as a regent for the regional university systems across Oklahoma, I will want to see strengthened colleges of education preparation programs. And we're in this space right now where we don't have enough built into the pipeline to be able to meet the needs of schools today. And I understand where we are, but that can't be lost in, we have to be partners.
Yeah, and that
I'm asking for that kind of assurance.
And so we've taken upon ourselves to convene the universities within the surrounding area. And we bring OU, OSU, NSU, ORU, Langston comes, and we bring all of the universities together. We sit and talk about the context of the individual teachers and students that we serve within the Tulsa Public Schools environment, and have made strides to think about, we know what percentage of our educators are coming from NSU. We also know, based on our observations of our educators that come from, and I'll use NSU as an example, where there are opportunities that we see based on, you know, first year, second year, third year data. And so we use that opportunity to go back to them and say, here's what we're seeing. How can we partner so that we're creating a stronger, more robust pipeline of educators within our system? Not only that, I think there's a significant opportunity for us to think about partnership from the perspective of every person who's in Tulsa Teacher Corps or an alternative pathway has a four-year degree. We are using this as an opportunity to build capacity as they're serving in the immediate. But there's also that bridge of continuing their and further advancing their education. And so how can we partner to enter, have them transition into master's programs and to think about masters of special education, where we know that there is a significant need. And what can we do as partners to potentially offset some of the costs so that that's not a significant barrier. And so we are having those conversations and excited to keep having those.
And one thing to add about our partnership with NSU, we're in the early One thing to add about our partnership with NSU, we're in the very early stages of adopting their Grow Your Own program. And so for us, as we think about our arc, it doesn't just start with individuals who have a bachelor's degree. Having a person who, an NSU faculty member, work with TPS students who are in high school, building their interest in education, hopefully they'll stay in a regional university. I think about, you got to recruit your state first, right? You got to get the best players in your state. Then you have an opportunity for them to cycle back. And whether it is through a Tulsa Teacher Corps or it is through another pathway, I had an opportunity to speak with a group of OU students on Saturday, and one of the young ladies who stopped me is like, I'm not a traditional education major, but I'm really passionate about Tulsa, and I'm really passionate about teaching. I do a lot of volunteer work in schools in Norman, and I want to know what other opportunities there are. So that's the kind of cycle that we want to continue to build. Many of the educators we have in our system were inspired by an educator that they had. We just want to make sure we're codifying a pathway so people know, particularly those who are going to be first-gen college graduates, know the steps to take to accomplish their dreams of taking our jobs one day.
Very nice. Ms. Moniz.
Can you, Superintendent Hoffmeister asked about special ed. Can you talk about, like, through the training, and what process do they, do your core members learn about, you know, writing IEPs? At what, is that before the boot camp? Is that during the boot camp? At what point do they transition to being able to do that themselves versus needing, can you talk about the IEP writing process and how that's a part of?
So in the current state, we are, we use boot camp as the mechanism.
That's the State Department of Education.
State Department of Education. What we are proposing is that we integrate boot camp into the Tulsa Teacher Corps. We do have for Tulsa Teacher Corps in its current state is focused on general education, but we know that and we believe wholeheartedly that the majority of our students should be spending time in general education classrooms, and so we spend a significant amount of time on the front end of building the capacity of general education teachers to understand how to serve diverse populations of students, to understand how to interpret student IEPs, and to know how to differentiate supports for those students. And what we'd like to do is bring the boot camp into Tulsa Teacher Corps so that our special education teachers are also building a strong strain of content knowledge and expertise along the way so that as students are being in general education classrooms or if they're self-contained, there is a robust set of supports that are focused on tier one and differentiated supports for the students where they are. And right now we know that there is a significant gap that exists. So it's moving what exists from the state into the program.
All right. Very good.
Yes, one more question.
Sorry. Last question, I promise. What is your...
It's fine, however many.
For individuals who, and I'm talking about number four up on the slide, for individuals who are already part of the program, what would be your reasonable expectation of when you start requesting certificates for the first individual? Would it be tomorrow if it's approved, or can you give us just a reasonable?
Yeah, so we would have to. For us, first it would be getting your approval, and then after we got your approval, we would then go to our members and ask them, this is the pathway forward. Would you like to continue on this pathway? You can stay on your traditional your emergency certification pathway, which you already have. Once we have the exact number of data and we can prove that we've met the milestones, we would come back to you and say, these are the number of people that we would like to request. I would say from a transition period, because it's letting them ride out their emergency certification for this year and then be before you in the summer for our board approval for that first set of individuals who have already started.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Bellamach. Oh.
First, thank you, Tulsa, for stepping up and taking this on. You clearly have a robust program here. I have a couple of questions in regards to when we're dealing with special education, if we're talking about waiving requirements or using a non-traditional pathway, are we allowed to do that on a federal level? I want to make sure we aren't running afoul of anything. Is there any problem with
As I've understood the explanation and what is in the application, in consulting with staff here, I do not believe it runs afoul of any of the requirements.
Okay. And keep in mind as well what the alternative also is, which is a substitute teacher that is in the classroom filling a role that has yet to be filled. So while not having a teacher that is certified and fully trained is obviously not ideal, this is a much better bridge. And it does comply with when we're referring to the boot camp through the OSDE.
Okay. And second is, in regards to waiving the requirement that someone take the OGET, one, is that a statutory requirement that somebody take OGET, the OGET test?
Sorry, I'm gonna turn that.
And then second is, I understand. I'm not totally grasping why we're going to use someone's high school ACT in their professional life. I just am not following why we're using that instead of the OGET.
Yeah, so My understanding is that is currently authorized.
To use the ACT?
It's an assessment of general knowledge.
Okay.
Correct. And it is currently an option to request that this process be utilized through the Office of Education, Quality, and Accountability. I can't speak to that specific process as a separate agency, but it's my understanding that is currently in place.
It's currently authorized.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. So we do have, I think Todd Lofton wants to speak to this. So Todd.
It's better than all the texts.
Yeah. Just come on. Come on to the microphone.
And I appreciate everything put together. One of my questions is, in the non-traditional route, you complete all of the hours for the boot camp and the field experience, 150 hours. Then you receive a certificate provisionally in mild, moderate, severe, profound. And at that point, you can write an IEP. So I just want to make it clear that these people would have, you could not, without a certificate, write an IEP or provide direct instruction to special ed kids without a certificate. So I'm wondering, and I didn't get this from reading through the document, whether or not, I think maybe that's the case, because you do have the list of pre-service requirements, and it says something like 120 to 160 hours, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, you spend 6 weeks with us over the course of six weeks times 40 hours.
We will need that on the audio recording, so if you could stand closer.
Over the course of the six-week period, they are spending about 240 hours with us on average.
Is what he was saying.
And at that point, they would apply for a provisional certificate with the State Department? Is that what you're suggesting?
Yes. Yeah, we would not come before you until we knew the individuals had passed our summer experience, that pre-service training. So the 240 hours they would need to complete and show proficiency in a number of different metrics in order to, before us to come to you and ask for the stamp of approval to move individuals forward.
Okay. So, because I just want to make sure that the teachers writing IEPs that are being judged by their peers, that they actually have a special ed certificate, that it's not given after the two-year period, correct?
Correct. Correct.
So it is essentially the boot camp, and then this is replacing for the non-standard, the non-traditional route, the college credit hours.
Correct.
Is that the thought? Okay.
That would be the thought. And so it's ultimately, we know that they're currently are for special education individuals who are interested in following that path. They enter into boot camp, and they're not eligible to provide direct instruction or to write IEPs. Until they've completed boot camp, and then they take boot camp, and then complete the process, and then also are at the same time are completing the other requirements from a certification perspective in many cases. And so we are moving the process to ensure that boot camp is happening with us in a coordinated effort over the course of the summer, where we're bringing other individuals in, so they're meeting their hours requirements at that point and then fulfilling the rest of the requirements as set forth.
I appreciate that. I just wanted to make that very clear. So
that was the intent, and I think what was
okay.
Very, very helpful. And just so for the audio record, Todd Lofton is
Todd Lofton, speaking. Special Education Director.
Thank you for the State Department of Ed.
Todd, while you're there, so based on this conversation you just had with the gentleman, any further concerns about the way this is written or no on your part? I want to hear from you since you deal with this every day on special ed.
The only special ed concerns that I have are that piece, because we do not want anybody writing an IEP that does not actually have a special ed certificate, because we have seen that around the state, and we correct that through our monitoring process. The only other concern I have is that, I have a couple, but one is that, you know, where we're placing these special ed teachers. Are we placing them in situations that they might not be ready for? And just thinking about that, are they being placed with other first-year teachers, that kind of thing, or veteran teachers? And then my third thing would be, when I went through the outline, and we can talk about this later, but I didn't see anything about positive behavior interventions and supports. I know we have a huge problem with suspensions with students with disabilities. I didn't see any of that, and I would wonder if the modules that you're creating, those should be developed using something like CEC standards, not just the CAPE standards, which is the Council for Exceptional Children. And there's a lot of things like that that should be incorporated.
So I think a couple of things. So within urban settings in general, what we find is that because of the needs, that many of our novice educators are placed in some of our most vulnerable and highest need areas, and we do as much as we possibly can to ensure that we're honoring where our teachers are and where they want to serve with the needs that are outlined in the district. And so we, you know, and with our more vulnerable populations, we have more control over where first-year educators are placed. We really push to ensure that they're in places where they're supported by seasoned professionals who understand the work, and they've got a mentor where they can receive coaching. And it's never our intent to, like, have a building full of first-years. We do know that in some of our more marginalized areas that often happens, and people are not willing to serve in those environments, and so we've got shortages, and that's something that we continue to work on, and that's why Tulsa Teacher Corps is really important, because we're able to recruit individuals with an intense purpose of knowing where they are going to serve, and then we're responsible for training and developing them to be ready. On the part around, what is the second?
PBIS.
So within the Tulsa Teacher Corps framework and within Tulsa Public Schools, more broadly, we've worked really intentionally over the last 3 years to ensure that we are reducing suspension for all of our students, particularly because we saw disproportionality in suspensions for our Black and Latinx students, particularly male and females in those areas, and have worked with our schools, worked with revamping our training and development on the front end to ensure that there are more restorative practices that were being put into place so that we weren't suspending students at disproportional rates. From an exceptional student perspective, while it's not explicitly in here, we do leverage a PBIS model in many cases, and so positive behavior intervention supports, as well as thinking about using a tiered intervention model to support our exceptional students, ensuring that our universal supports, targeted supports, and more intensive supports, that we've got a plan in place for that. And while not explicitly written, we've got a whole team of folks who are working to ensure that that is happening.
Thank you.
Just one more comment about the way in which this document was written and who was a part of the process. As I mentioned, I had the great pleasure of launching this initiative, but because Devin's scope expands talent and academics, our executive director of exceptional student support was a part of writing this document, and that's our special education department. So it was with an eye always to how do we support all of our students, but then the students with a specific need, we wanted to make sure that everyone was around the table who was going to help us to implement the programming in accordance with the federal regulations, state regulations, and what is best practice.
All right, very good. Any other questions?
They're really short. So just to clarify on number 5, as you expand beyond or think to expand beyond elementary and special ed, you would come back and ask for permission to go into different areas.
That would be correct. The team here would be the jurying group that would give us or grant us authorization to do so.
I just wanted to make sure that we weren't like allowing that without coming back. The only other question that I had was, I know one of your core missions is to recruit a diverse set of teachers. I didn't see it anywhere in there. Can you kind of talk about your first cohort and what that looks like and how that's borne out?
The first cohort, and Quentin, you can push me if I'm going to go, we had 50% individuals of color who were a part of that cohort, 50% male, female, and we had, a variety of people with differing abilities and orientations that were a part of our program. And so we were really excited about our first cohort, and the second year mirrored it pretty closely. And we are, so we've got, a diverse representation on many levels, and our students were truly able to see themselves in the cohort of individuals that we brought on so far. And that has been a intentional and consistent push for us. And it's happened relatively organically. And I think the most exciting piece is that the large number of individuals are folks who are Tulsa or Oklahoma natives and like have a desire to serve in the communities that have our greatest needs. And so that's been really awesome to see.
That's wonderful.
The only thing that I'll add is that because of our program is at no cost to the individual, we know cost can be particularly prohibitive to those who are from marginalized communities. So if you have made your way through a bachelor's program, you're a first-generation college student, you may or may not have student loan debt, and then have decided education's a calling and it can happen at any point in your life. You've decided that this is where you want to be and how you want to serve. Being able to enter in through Tulsa Teacher Corps provides that opportunity. We value higher education. We want people to continue on, but we also don't want to be in the way of someone accomplishing their dream and, most importantly, accomplish someone's calling, not in the business of that.
Mr. Flanagan.
I want to congratulate you all for your thorough presentation and professional presentation. You had all the answers, and so I just want to say we appreciate that.
Very good.
I have a question, Brad, on the just for public comment purposes. If approved today, this is for 1 year, and then they would be required to come back annually for updates and future approvals. Am I correct in understanding that? Or?
Yes, sir. In the statute that we were talking about along the way, there is a requirement that there's an annual report to be provided. And I will also add that at any time the state board believes that the provider has not met the requirements, the board may seek to suspend or disapprove upon proper notice and an opportunity for the provider to come forward.
Okay.
I would like to thank you for your time and congratulate you on putting such a robust and really detailed plan, not only for Tulsa, but I sure hope that this is something that best practices can be done across the entire state of Oklahoma. For me, you have answered, and I think many of the concerns that that many of us had in our minds have been touched upon. One of the things that I would like to see moving forward as I'm prepared to make a motion to approve this application is the next time around is for you to kind of bring and talk on number six on the law that requires result-oriented approach and best practices, and really kind of seeing where you are today and kind of where you are in looking at those numbers the year following or the next year. But with that said, I would like to make a motion to approve the application.
Second. Second by Ms. Carlicia Bradley-Williams. And we have any other discussion or comments? All right, please call the roll.
Ms. Hernandez?
Aye.
Ms. Williams Bradley?
Aye.
Mr. Bobek?
Aye.
Mr. Ballenbach?
Aye.
Ms. Munns?
Aye.
Mr. Flanagan?
Yes.
Yes. All right. That motion carries. Congratulations and thank you for all the hard work.
Thank you very much.
All right. Very good. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, board members, we have items to consider for the rule promulgation process, and we have item 9. Where we will consider three rules. And Ms. Lori Murphy, please present to the board.
Good morning, honorable members of the board. As the superintendent mentioned, we have three rules for your consideration today. One of them will take a little bit more explanation than the others, and we will start there. At item 9A1 on your agenda, the rule on length of term. This is a rule amendment that's required due to a change in statute from last legislative session. A little bit of context, the statute that requires this rule change is the law that set historically the minimum length of a school year for Oklahoma public schools. And historically, for many decades, that was 180 days, and each school day had to be at least 6 hours long. That was in place up through 2009. There was an amendment to that statute authorizing schools to use 1,080 total hours, which is the equivalent of 186-hour days, to design their schedules. So that's the context in which last spring the legislature again amended that statute on the length of the school term, providing that districts still have the option to use 1,080 hours as the basis for a school year, but that beginning in school year 2021-2022, the minimum number of days in a school calendar must be 165 days. So that is a change that has occurred in statute through Senate Bill 441, an act of the legislature last spring. But as part of that law change, setting a new minimum of 165 days, the statute also authorizes this board, the State Board of Education, to establish guidelines to make a school district eligible for a waiver of that 165-day minimum. And the statute directs that that has to be based on student performance guidelines and also financial criteria. So based on that statutory change and directive to this board, last fall, the State Department of Education convened a task force of education stakeholders to discuss recommendations for the school calendar and what these criteria would be that are recommended for a school district to be eligible for that waiver. So I would just note that that task force did cover a great cross-section of school demographics, representing school leaders from urban and rural districts, from all areas of the state, large and small schools, and four-day and five-day school calendar districts. So that task force met a number of times to develop recommendations for this rule, and while not every single member of that task force agreed on every recommendation, the rule language proposed is based on general consensus of the group for the recommendations made. So before I address specifics of the rule, I would note that there was a great deal of feedback through public comment on this particular rule change. And you have in your materials a chart of public comments and the agency's responses to those that take you through some of the issues that were raised. I would point out a number of the comments, probably the majority, seem to be based on the idea that the law change and this rule change ban 4-day school weeks. And that is not the effect of either the statute or the proposed rule. The 1,080 hours option is still available. Even for a district that does not qualify for a waiver, the 165-day minimum is required for a district that does not qualify for a waiver. But within that, it is still up to a district's discretion how to structure the school year. So there is still a great deal of flexibility. I just wanted to point out because a number of the public comments seem to be in response to that idea. So based on the public comments received, there are a couple of changes to the proposed language, but I will take you through what is the final proposed language you see for criteria. Different student performance criteria apply to different grade levels, grade bands, and so you will see different eligibility criteria as you look at the rule for early childhood centers, elementary and middle schools, and high schools. And the proposed rule also provides that every site that's included in a district's waiver request has to meet the criteria that apply to that site. So for an elementary school, elementary criteria, high school has to meet the high school criteria. So what those criteria are that are recommended for your consideration today, for an early childhood center, the school that the early childhood site feeds into must meet all the eligibility criteria for elementary schools. The reason for that is there are not a lot of accountability measures for pre-K through second grade centers. That's an early childhood center. And so for those very early grades, the criteria is the qualifying criteria of the elementary schools that that site feeds into. So for elementary and middle school sites, the student performance criteria are that the school's student growth indicator letter grade is a C or higher on the most recent Oklahoma school report card issued under the school accountability system, and that the school is not currently identified for comprehensive support and improvement, targeted support and improvement, or additional targeted support and improvement. These are classifications that have to be made as part of ESSA, the Every Student Succeeds Act. So those are the elementary site criteria. And for high school, The recommended criteria are that the school's four-year cohort graduation rate is at or above the most recently reported state average, or 82%, whichever is higher. That's because that is currently the most recently reported state average, so that is a baseline being set by the proposed rule. For a high school, the school's academic achievement indicator must also be a C or higher on the most recent school report card. And for high schools, which include post-secondary indicators, the post-secondary indicator on the most recent report card must be at a C or higher. And for high schools, like the other sites, a site may not be identified for comprehensive support and improvement or targeted support and improvement in order to be eligible. So those are the student performance criteria that are split out by grade band. The financial criteria are the same for all districts and all sites. And the rationale for that is that it was a discussion in the task force meetings that districts have very different situations and resource levels and very different contexts. So the proposed financial criteria is that each district applying for a waiver needs to submit a budget and also a narrative describing cost savings. So that budget would look the same for every district. It is meant to be the estimate of needs submitted to the county. But the narrative describing cost savings is intended to give districts an opportunity to articulate those things that are maybe more difficult to articulate with a chart of numbers, how it is that the finance translates into being a value for their district. So if you have any questions about this rule, we have Executive Director of Accountability, Maria Harris, available if you have any specific questions on those criteria guidelines. But do you have any questions on the content of the rule or any of the public comments or responses?
Well, I thought you did an excellent job of recording both the audio recording. I know each of you had that for any of those who showed up for audio record of public comment. I know we all listened to that, and there were maybe about seven or so that were there for this, but then a number here that you've responded to each individually. Everyone who made a public comment, Lori, recorded that comment and responded to that in this document that we have available online for public review. And I appreciate that. So I do want to also recognize nearly 100 people that I know were a part of the working group, Mr. Bobek and Mr. Flanagan and Ms. Hernandez. Others of you were able to hear that. Those are all stored in the audio record as well. If you want to listen to all 20-some hours of that conversation, where we worked with a facilitator that's familiar with our school accountability system and our state assessment system to ensure that we weren't using things that would not be appropriate or weren't intended for those purposes. And so we appreciate all of that work. I just want to say that as we get started on this.
There's a great deal of work that went into the proposal and a great deal of engagement from the public, which
is... And we had a number of legislators that were also a part of that for those who weren't in the room during that time, and we appreciate them as well.
So any questions about specifics of this rule before I move on to the next? Okay, at item 9A2 in your agenda, this is section 210.25.3.4, the personnel rule. So this is a proposed amendment that would add an authorization for a teacher who's received workers' compensation while employed as a teacher to credit that time when they've received their disability benefits toward teacher experience credit. And the reason that matters is because if a teacher is injured mid-year, potentially they're out half the year with their disability that's related to a work injury. Under the existing rule, we didn't have an authorization clarifying that you could add workers' comp experience, that you're certified as an employee of the district receiving temporary total disability, although the teacher's retirement system had that possibility available to have workers' comp time added to your retirement account. So this proposed amendment brings our teacher experience rule into alignment with the teacher's retirement system rule on allowing workers' comp credit to accrue toward total teacher experience. So the way that works is you have to have been employed as a teacher while you received the work-related injury, and you have to have been employed by a school district also immediately before and after, and the district has to certify the dates that you were receiving those benefits and that you were employed by them during that time. And that parallels the existing authorization for workers' comp time to count toward retirement purposes. This would allow it to accrue as well toward salary schedule purposes, so if you're injured mid-year, you don't lose that year toward your teacher service accrual. So any questions about that? It's a workers' comp authorization that brings us in alignment with teachers' retirement for service.
So that brings it in conformity to both sets of rules.
Yes. There is not a specific statutory authorization for this service credit, but it is parallel to existing authorizations, and so we've discussed that with the other entities and imported the same rules.
It has a financial effect of zero?
On a teacher and on a district, there will not be a net financial effect. If someone's years of service could ultimately be credited with another year, from this point on, if they're injured, that in the future would somewhat affect their salary. There would be a spread out net effect on people being able to be paid slightly more. But there's no immediate effect to districts or teachers. Any questions on that change? The last rule change proposed for you today, section 210, number 35232, Oklahoma Middle, Junior High, or High School Honor Society. This is a rule that sets out the eligibility guidelines for a student to participate in an honor society, specifically that is authorized by this board through meeting criteria. Historically, that rule has provided that if you are in the top 10% of your school's students by GPA, the school may nominate you for honor society membership. We are needing to make a clarification to that rule that a district may have in place a policy for determining tiebreakers if more than 10% of the student body are tied for the same GPA. And we are also adding a provision that if you don't establish that tiebreaker policy, all students who are tied for the eligible GPA are eligible for Honor Society membership. And the reason for that is there are some small school districts where that 10% number is a small number of students. And you have students who are all tied for exactly the same GPA. So if a school doesn't have an existing policy for determining tiebreakers, it's not appropriate to recommend these two students but not this one student for membership in the Honor Society. So this makes it predictable that if you want to develop a tiebreaker policy, taking into account attendance or other factors, extracurriculars, a district may do that. Without a policy for tiebreakers of your top 10% students, everyone eligible gets nominated. That has come up the last couple of years as districts ask questions about those honor societies. Any questions about that or any of these rule changes?
All right, board members.
As Lori typically says, you can approve all of these or disapprove at once, or you can take them individually. So,
I'd make a motion to approve all three rules at once.
Second.
Very good. Any other comments or questions? Okay, seeing none, please call the roll.
Ms. Moniz?
Aye.
Mr. Belbeck?
Aye.
Mr. Flanagan?
Yes.
Ms. Williams-Bradley?
Aye.
Mr. Ballenbach?
Aye.
Ms. Hernandez?
Aye.
Superintendent Hoffman?
Aye. All right, motion carries. Thank you very much. Thank you for all the work as well. At this time, board members, we're on item number 9B, which is a possibility of going into executive session. Is that recommended?
It is on items 9B, C, D, and E and F.
E and F.
So moved.
All right, is there a second? And we have a second. Please call the roll.
Ms. Hernandez?
Aye.
Mr. Ballenbach?
Aye.
Ms. Williams-Bradley?
Aye.
Mr. Flanagan?
Yes.
Mr. Bobeck?
Aye.
Ms. Moniz?
Aye.
Aye. All right, we are moving into executive session. Thank you to those who attended and are excusing yourselves now from. All right, call the roll. Are we on? Thank you. Okay.
Ms. Hernandez?
Aye.
Mr. Ballenbach?
Aye.
Mr. Flanagan?
Yes.
Mr. Bobeck?
Aye.
Ms. Moniz?
Aye.
Superintendent Hoffman?
Aye. All right, we are out of executive session. During executive session, we were briefed with guests in from the auditor's office, state auditor's office, as well as two members of our legal team, Lori Murphy and Talana as
McCullough.
And that's everything. But no decisions were made or votes taken during session. All right. Now, is there any recommendations for the board?
Board members, at this time, I'm sorry, I prepared it. Did we vote to come out?
We did.
Thank you. I'm so sorry.
We just did it.
Okay, at this time, we would recommend action on the five individuals for proposed revocation.
So moved. Second.
All right. Any other discussion?
No.
Okay, please call the roll.
Ms. Moniz?
Aye.
Mr. Bobeck?
Aye.
Mr. Flanagan?
Yes.
Mr. Ballenbach?
Aye.
Ms. Hernandez?
Aye.
Superintendent Hoffman?
Aye. Okay.
All right, and secondly, at this time, request appropriate action to enter an emergency order suspending the teaching certificates of Joyce Churchwell and John Horner.
So moved.
Second.
Okay, motion and second. Any discussion? Seeing none, please call the roll.
Ms. Hernandez?
Aye.
Mr. Ballenbach?
Aye.
Mr. Flanagan?
Yes.
Mr. Bobeck?
Aye.
Ms. Moniz?
Aye.
Superintendent Hoffmeister?
Aye. All right, very good. Does that conclude?
That does conclude.
Any recommendations? Thank you. Item 10, new business. Any new business? Okay, seeing none, we'll entertain a motion to adjourn.
So moved.
Second.
All right, motion and a second. All in favor say aye.
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 That is unanimous. We are adjourned. There we go. Thank you.
You're going to leave it.